The time is 8:32 on April 22nd, 2024, and I'm convening this video conference and telephone conference meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life, Health, Insurance Guarantee Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act and the Association's antitrust policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the Association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed April 11, 2024, and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Record Act. A copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official meetings, minutes of this meeting. A quorum is achieved. Nine directors have been confirmed as attended in person or by video or audio conference.
Only eight.
Eight have been confirmed. We're expecting Dean Forgo to join us in the next few minutes. Also in attendance are Texas Life and Health Guarantee Association Executive Director Boyd Bowles, General Counsel Jackie Rickson, employees Jared Terry, Toppin Haggerty, and Brandon Nichols. And from the Texas Department of Insurance, attendant are Vance Hugo, Sandra Salazar, Jeff Jones, John Walker, Sean Morton, and Mandy Vasquez. Now we will move to our agenda. Item one, consideration and possible action on consent agenda. A summary of the official minutes of the January 30th, 2024 meeting of the Board of Directors and ratification of the payments of NOVA's fees and expense billings for fourth quarter 2023. These items are addressed in the suggested resolution on page 1-1 of the briefing material. Has everyone had a chance to review the consent agenda items?
Yeah.
Is there to approve? Okay, we have a motion by Frank to approve. Is there a second? All right, we have Jim with a second. All in favor?
Aye.
The motion carries. Thank you. Next, we'll move to agenda item two. And that's Dean. Do we skip that or?
Since we have Bhakti here, before we go ahead and do it, and Bhakti, did you want to share your slide deck?
Yes, I can share it, Bart.
Let me stop sharing, allow you to share. Give me just a moment.
Okay.
Could you maybe say that they have a meeting and you're allowed to say that?
I'll say that real quick. So just as an intro, Chair Huckabee, the audit committee did meet on April 9th and reviewed a number of items. What we're going to start with today was the draft audit report as of 12/31/2023. That was conducted by Clifton Larson Allen. So we have Bhakti Patel, principal with CLA, here to present her findings. So I'm going to stop sharing, allow Ms. Bhakti to share her screen and walk through her summary of the report.
Thank you. I think it's showing disabled screen sharing, Bart. You may have to give me access.
I had done that. Could you try again, Bhakti?
Okay. Yep. Now I have it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, good morning to everyone. Thank you for allowing me to speak for a few minutes this morning. I have a brief presentation over the results of our fiscal year 2023 audit of the association, which I'll go through. I'm happy to answer any questions at the end. I'll go through this pretty quickly. Not much to report here, but happy to answer any questions anyone has. So a quick agenda. I'll go over our scope of work and our deliverables, the results of the audit, and some financial highlights. Nothing should be a surprise to the board, but just when we look at year over year, some highlights there. And then some of the required communications we are required to do as part of our audit, and then our steps for finalization as we finalize that audit and we release that audit report. So our scope of work was really to audit the financial statements of the association for the year ended December 31, 2023. So it's for those 12 months. We do perform some limited procedures over the, what we call our required supplementary information, which is that management's discussion analysis that you see in that report. So those limited procedures were really making sure it's mathematically accurate, it's consistent with the information in the report, and then consistent with the supporting documentation that we received as part of the audit. We do perform our audit in accordance with generally accepted auditing standards, and we propose journal entries as needed. And then we also look at the fiscal year 23 annual report for consistency. So there's several other sections in the overall annual report. While we don't opine on all those sections, we do read all of it to make sure it's consistent with those audited financials that are tagged with our audit opinion. So our overall deliverables, we do issue our independent auditor's report, which you'll see on the in the front of those financial statements. We are required to issue internal control communications if we see any deficiencies in internal controls or really even any best practices that we feel that management needs to know. It has an NA here because we didn't identify any internal control deficiencies as part of our audit. So if we did, we would have issued this communication, but nothing to communicate there. And then we have a governance communication letter that has been issued to the board and audit committee. Really just a more detailed view of what I'm going to summarize here today. So the results of our audit, we issued our independent auditor's report. We issued an unmodified opinion. This is the highest level of assurance that we can give as an auditor, as an external auditor. So no issues, no modifications in our opinion there. We did not have any proposed uncorrected audit adjustments. These arise when we have audit adjustments that we've identified, but they're not material enough and management can make a decision whether or not they'd like to correct them. There were none proposed. So any adjustments that were identified by management or us are in that or in the report that you have there today with you. And we have no corrected audit adjustments. So what this means is adjustments that we identified as part of our audit that management did not make. We didn't identify anything as part of our audit. All of those adjustments were identified as part of management's closing procedures. So no audit adjustments that we proposed that were corrected by management either. So. Our internal control communications, as I mentioned, we didn't identify any, but these are just some definitions here. Should we have identified any on these buckets that they fall into? So I'm not going to really go into those definitions, but we didn't have any written recommendations that were provided to management. Now, as part of our audit, we'll go through, we'll identify things here and there, but nothing to that rose to the level of a written recommendation as part of our audit. So moving on, and those were the results of our audit. Moving on to some financial statement highlights. Again, none of these are probably a surprise to the board. These are all in the board minutes and have been discussed at length, but just some year-over-year changes. These are comparative statements. So you'll see the 2023 numbers and the 2022 balances there. So you can see that year-over-year comparison. And what that management's discussion analysis does is really goes through and helps the reader understand what changed and why it changed. So this is a little brief overview of that. So cash and cash equivalents did increase about $32.78 million, mainly due to the need for the cash to fund one of those new insolvencies that happened this year. Unbilled assessments also increased by about $19 million. There were, as you know, those new insolvencies, Friday Health Insurance, Bright Health Insurance, and Southland National Insurance Company. So those unbilled assessments increases because of that. And in the same note, insurance contractual obligations increased $26.58 million because of those new insolvencies. Those new insolvencies, new obligations. So those are really the big reasons for the swing in that number from 2022 to 2023. As we move to the statement of revenues, expenses, and changes in that position, our overall net position, which is that bottom number, our equity, for lack of better words here, it did increase by $2.78 million, mainly due to those receivership estate distributions. And then estate recoveries increased by about $33.89 million because of those large recoveries from Friday Health Insurance and Penn Treaty. So that swung because of that. So those are the big, there were other swings, but those were the significant swings in those numbers and why those happened. Again, probably not a surprise to the board. These were all discussed at length through those board meetings throughout the year. Significant footnotes behind those financial statements, you'll see those note disclosures. These are just some significant because of the significance to the entity as a whole. Note five, we always note as a significant footnote. It's those membership assessments. There were none in 2022 or 2023, but that is a big part of what the association does and where that revenue may come from. So that is a significant footnote, and we took a look at that. Note 16, also because of those commitments and contingencies. Again, on the other side, those that liability side, what the association does. That's also, we identified that as a significant footnote. Now, we looked at all of the footnotes. These are just significant footnotes that we looked at because of the impact to the overall association. Some required communications. We did identify the first bullet point here, significant risks. Not to say we identified any issues there. What we do as part of our planning procedures, it's a risk-based audit. So we identify where are the risky areas, where do we need to do more audit work? And it could be anything from just a quantitative issue. It could be we had issues in the past. It could be because there's some uncertainty. So these we've identified: management override of controls, which is a risk in any audit that we do, especially in smaller organizations. Unbilled assessments receivables, proof of claims receivables, and insurance contractual obligations. The last three are mainly because those are highly dependent on estimate numbers. Those are estimates being put together. So there is some assumptions and some uncertainty in those numbers. So we identified significant risks over those and did more audit work over those just to make sure that those numbers are accurate. We did have a new accounting standard this year that was implemented, GASB 96, which is our subscription-based information technology arrangements. We looked at management's assessment over that and what they concluded as far as whether there are any that meet the definition of SBTA, is what we call these. We looked at that as part of management's estimates or management's evaluation. There were none that met that definition of a SBTA that would have had to that we would have had to book this liability for. We reviewed it, did some testing over it, and we agreed with management's analysis that there were no agreements that meet that definition of SBTAs. There were no new accounting policies or changes in existing accounting policies, and no transactions entered into where there was any lack of authoritative guidance. As I mentioned over here on the significant risk, we do look at those estimates and disclosures, and we look at those separately. We look at those underlying assumptions management's used to see if there's any management bias in these estimates, and then look at any his if a historical look back does make sense, we look at that as well to make sure that those estimates going forward look accurate. So these were your insurance contractual obligations, unbilled assessments, and the allowance for doubtful accounts that are on the financial statements. We were comfortable with management's estimates, looked at all of those inputs and assumptions, and comfortable with what is reported there in those financial statements. We didn't identify any sensitive financial statement disclosures. As part of our communications, we are required to communicate how the audit went, not only what the audit resulted in, if we had any difficulties or disagreements. So happy to report no difficulties, no disagreements as part of our audit. Management provided everything in a very timely manner, as always, as in the past, timely, and provided responses to everything that we needed. Just a few other things. Just for communications to the board, management did not consult with any other accountants that we're aware of about any auditing or accounting matters. No matters were discussed prior to our engagement that were that no matters were discussed that were prior to our engagement that were a condition to our engagement, which keeps us independent, meaning we're not taking a certain position on any accounting matters, and that's the only reason that we'd be engaged to do the audit. We are completely independent, so no matters were discussed before that. And then we do have a representation letter that we've actually already received here that management's represented that they provided us all of the information based on their understanding and to the best of their knowledge and haven't held anything back as part of the audit. So my last slide here, just some steps to finalization. We've already reviewed that draft annual report. We'll review if there's any final changes in there to make sure that everything still looks consistent with those audited financial statements. We do a communication of subsequent events, including the claims. And so we've actually received this morning. Our what we call our down-to-date procedures, just to see is there any liability out there that may have impacted the financial statements or subsequent event that needs to be disclosed in those financial statements. We do that all the way up to our report date, which is today. So we received those communications this morning from management. And then the board approval of reports, which we are doing here today. And then that representation letter, which we've actually received from management. So really just looking at that last communication, subsequent events, any changes to that draft annual report to see if they're make sure they're material consistent, and then today's approval. And then we should be finalizing our audit. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm going to stop sharing here, but happy to answer any questions anybody in the board members have.
Are there any questions for Bhakti? Bhakti, thank you very much for your report. Dean has not signed in, so I will thank you on behalf of the committee, if that's all right, Patty.
That's fine, and I'm happy to make the resolution at the appropriate time.
So feel free, and then Bhakti, I'll let you hear the resolution, and then we'll excuse you. But go right ahead.
I move or resolve that the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association accept the year-end 2023 financial audit report as presented today.
Thank you, Patty. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, Frank, second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 The ayes have it. The motion carries.
And Bhakti, thank you for your report and your work along with your team. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Bhakti.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for your time this morning.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. So in the absence of Dean, he's not connected yet. I'll just cover a couple other items that the audit committee addressed on April 9th. These do not involve any action items. As always, the committee looks at the draft audit report and says, is there anything in that audit report that would warrant possible expansion or edits to the 2024 audit plan that has been recommended and adopted by the board and reported to the Commissioner of Insurance? And the committee found there were no adjustments necessary. Then the committee did hear an executive session of their meeting from me on the internal and external network penetration testing and phishing testing. I will discuss those in the executive session today. And then, as always, in the April meeting, Jarrett prepares a year-end 2023 final actual expense to budgeted numbers comparison. So we go back through with the committee and say, hey, how did our budget work out against actual expenses? So after that review, the committee seemed comfortable. There's nothing that they wanted to address. And their last item was the annual review of the committee's charter. And the committee discussed it and found there was no reason to edit or change their charter in any way. And that was everything that the audit committee addressed on April 9th.
Thank you very much. That moves us to item three.
Okay.
Item three is the General Counsel Search Committee report. I believe, is that Ted?
That is Mr. Kennedy.
Ms. Kennedy.
Thank you, Chair. Committee. The committee's initial meeting was held on March 25th. The committee reviewed the items listed in the report and then asked Jackie and Barr to update several items and begin drafting the package that will be distributed regarding the requirements for this position, the materials to be provided with any application, and the process to review applications and schedule interviews. The board will need to provide information on its level of involvement in the process as the committee moves forward. It's anticipated that the process will be conducted with the intent of bringing qualified applicants for consideration back to the board for consideration July 23rd, 2024 meeting. Negotiation of engagement terms would take place in August and September for the engagement of the new council beginning October at the October board meeting. The last 2 months of the year would then be used for transition. It's a summary, thank you, Bart, of our discussion at the initial committee meeting, search committee for the general counsel. Any questions?
And Chair Kennedy, I'll just ask the board. You have a very capable committee here, and they've provided a lot of good feedback and direction to Jackie and I. I believe they are prepared to move forward with the distribution of the notice packet, which would have the application process, and get that ball rolling. Then the review of any applications received, and that would occur, and actually the initiation of interviewing before the July Board of Directors meeting. It's just flagged in Chair Kennedy's comments that the level of involvement of the board is always up for discussion. So if any board member wants to participate in any activities of the committee or the interviews of the applicants, I think Chair Kennedy, would it be best they just contact both you and I and we can discuss that?
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. And for those that aren't a part of the committee but would like to participate, we're tentatively penciling in the middle of June for these discussions.
Thank you, Chair Kennedy, for your report and as well as the committee and your hard work. Thank you very much and very detailed information, and we appreciate your oversight of this area for the association. Next, we'll move to item four, and that is Chair Harrison. If you would report consideration, possible actions on reports, recommendations from the Assessment Investment Committee. So if you would take it from there, sir.
Thank you. The Assessment Investment Committee did meet last Tuesday on the 16th. Myself, Ted Kennedy, and Dean Frigo. The purpose of the meeting was to discuss, consider a possible Class B assessment for Bankers Life Insurance Company and Colorado Bankers Life Insurance Company. We've talked about those companies for quite a while now. Normally, we do not meet until July, but we had scheduled this early meeting anticipation of needing those funds quicker than a July meeting would allow. Initially, Bart, we were thinking June 30 at the time was possible. That's now out the window. Still likely though that we'll need the funds before we could make it all work for the July meeting. So we do have a recommendation. I'll discuss that in a minute for a Class B, but maybe I'll turn it over to you, Bart, for a quick summary of the timing issue.
Just to recap and for the record here, the liquidation orders for these companies, Bankers Life and Colorado Bankers, were entered December 30th, 2022. Now, those orders did
have... Oh, good. We're tomorrow. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got a meeting tonight.
Dean, welcome to the meeting.
Are you there, Bart?
Yes, we have you. Thank you very much, Dean. Well, we'll note that, and I'll continue. So Colorado Bankers and Bankers Life, when that order was entered, I believe the court anticipated there might be some challenge to the liquidation orders. So the language permitted, and I'll summarize it. I think I did put it in the committee's packet, but not in this board packet, that the liquidation orders become effective on the first month in 90 days after the final resolution of any challenge to the liquidation orders. So with that being said, there was an appeal filed by the holding company and shareholder of the companies. And that was resolved with a decision from the North Carolina Court of Appeals on, I believe it was March 5th. And they affirmed the liquidation order. And that was a 30-day, there was an appeal period. And on April 9th, I believe that was the last day after the order was actually entered, that the shareholder could appeal, and they did file a petition for review with the North Carolina Supreme Court. And Jackie, any comment you want to mention about timing or consideration of that petition?
Well, the only thing I can say is we don't know how quickly the North Carolina Supreme Court might get to that. So it could be that, you know, they take things in the order in which they come before them, which means if they've got a lot of stuff in the pipeline already, it might be a while before they even look at it. Or it could be if their practice is they look at things as they come in and make a quick decision on, yes, we're going to entertain this, no, we're not going to entertain it. It could be relatively soon. So we don't know.
So once we got into April and we knew that we had this 90-day window for the liquidation orders become final, that pushed June 30th effective date out the window. We're looking at July 31st. As we move forward and we get to May, it'll shift another month. We'll look at August 31st. And we don't know. So it depends on whether the North Carolina Supreme Court affirms, denies, or they could schedule hearings. We don't know what they're going to do on this action. So it seems like the very earliest right now, the liquidation orders could become effective is July 31st, probably more likely August 31st or after. With that being said, when we went to the committee, we did not know how soon the funding might be needed. We do know, and this is old, kind of an old story. I've said it several times, but it's always good to build it into the record. These companies have been in rehabilitation for many years. They've been subject to a moratorium on the voluntary surrenders or exchanges or loans under these annuity contracts since June of 2019. Surrender charges on almost all the annuity contracts have expired. So without that moratorium order, the annuity contract owners would have had full access to their money. With that being said, once a liquidation order becomes effective, the moratorium is no longer in place, and we feel that most of these policyholders will request either immediate cash surrender or 1035 exchange to other carriers of their value of their annuities. With that thought, what does that mean? Well, to the system, for all the guarantee associations, is about $1.7 billion. To this association, the covered cash surrender value of the annuity contracts for both companies, it's $57.2 million for Bankers Life, $45 million for Colorado Bankers. So $102.2 million of cash surrender value exposure. That calculation does take in consideration guarantee association coverage limits, but it is calculated as of June 30th, 2024. So there will be some value to carry forward for a small interest accumulation since that date, but there won't be a significant change. Will all the policyholders surrender immediately? No, I think at least 75% of them will. There'll be some that will need to think about and do some planning how best to position their assets and move their money. So not all will immediately, but we wanted to make sure we had the ability to meet our funding obligations. So we did recommend to the committee, I think Jim will carry on after I'm finished here, to talk about Class B assessments for each company in total of $102.2 million. Now, since the liquidation orders are not effective, we are asking that the committee is recommending that the board authorize the assessment, but not yet call it. The assessment will be called when it is actually distributed. If 180 days have passed and the assessment is not called, the association is required to provide a notice per statute to each member insurer with their estimated share. So I do anticipate that notice will be unnecessary because I think we will have an effective liquidation date before 6 months have passed. So this is a little bit of a preemptive measure to make sure we have the authority and the ability to assess. Staff is already working to prepare. These assessments would be the first assessments we have conducted virtually. Normally, our assessments are sent out by hard copy mail. We now have collected email addresses for almost all 1,100 companies. I think we're missing 62 email addresses, and letters are going out this week to those 62 to try to get email contacts. And we work with the vendor that provides our assessment system, and they can send out the assessments directly through their process via email. So it'll be a much more expedited process, be much easier because a snail mail The Postal Service, we always have a few that just get lost. So that's kind of a summary of where we are on Colorado Bankers and Bankers Life, where we are in the assessment process. And Chair Harrison, I think we're ready.
Yeah, so the committee, I think, Bart, you mentioned probably 60 days to get everything out and collect the funds. So even though that the timing's been delayed because of the appeal, if we are looking at August 31st, taking action in July still doesn't really give us enough time. So the committee, there's a resolution there on page 4-2, does provide that the board would authorize, as Bart said, a Class B assessment totaling $102.2 million, and that the committee or the board would authorize Bart to call the assessment at such time that the liquidation is filed.
Committee Chair Harrison, I'm going to accept that as a motion.
It is.
Is there a second regarding the resolution? Ted, second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you. Motion carries. That brings us to item number 5, consideration possible action regarding any matters presented by the Texas Department of Insurance. And they have nothing to...
Happy to say we have nothing on the horizon.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Better use it last year.
All right. With that being said, we will move to item 6, quarterly report from our executive director, Bart.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Huckabee. This will be a very brief report because most of the items I've normally discussed will be covered into other items on the agenda. So I'll just mention a couple of meetings that have been held recently and my role and others' role in those meetings on behalf of the association. There was a resolution workshop a week before last in New Orleans. I agreed to chair that workshop. And then I also do, as usual, all the AV work for IAIR on these workshops. This was a little unique. IAIR has not done a workshop that focuses on all the activities pre-liquidation. So this was only dealing with rehabilitations and supervisions. The authority of the regulators to take those actions, their intent, what they're trying to accomplish, their challenges. Then we went through stage by stage, kind of a chronological walkthrough, what can be done, what are the tools available, what it means, what actions taken in supervision or rehabilitation, how that impacts the Life Health Guarantee Association or PNC Guarantee Association. We had some case studies. And then we had some forward looking, where do we go from here? What's on the horizon in the future and how this might be changing? So it was very well attended, about 95 or so attendees. We had a very lively discussion and I've received a lot of feedback on it. That's the last workshop I'm chairing for IAIR. I think I've done 4 of them now, but I will share with the group. I brought this. So give me a moment.
Okay.
Wow. I was presented with an award by IAIR. So I received the 2023 Distinguished Service Award from IAIR.
Congratulations.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you. I thought I'd share that because it was a little bit of a surprise. I'm on the board and I do vote on this every year. We've done this. This is the third time we've done it.
So it's kind of like Godfather 2 or something.
But the IAIR manager sent me a ballot to vote on 2 nominees. And I wasn't in the list of nominees. So I thought, okay, I vote. And I want to make sure, do I need to carve out time in the agenda to make the presentation? And I will take care of it. So when it came time to do this, I didn't know they were doing it. I wasn't in the room. It was lunchtime. I was back in the meeting room. I was on a conference call with another Guarantee Association administrator on an issue we're having an insolvency, and someone comes and says, Bart, we need your help down here. I said, well, I'm busy right now. I'm on the phone. I said, but we need your help. And I said, okay, I'll be there just a minute. So I went in there. They surprised me and had this little presentation. Aww. So
that's pretty smart of them.
Yeah.
That means you're going to follow through next year.
That's right.
But anyway, it was a very successful workshop. NEIC meeting was held in Phoenix. Recently, I attended that. Jim Harrison, I believe I saw you there. It was a good meeting. I left Phoenix. It's not on the list here, but I left Phoenix, went directly to San Diego for the ILTCI, the annual long-term care conference of all the companies that write long-term care, most of the vendors in that space. It's been getting more and more attention because some of the work we're doing in the Penn Treaty block of business is kind of groundbreaking. Some of the work we're doing on wellness, we're not quite the leader, but pretty close to being the leader in the long-term care space in doing wellness programs. Also, I didn't put on the list. Sorry, I've missed a few things in this report. Last week, there was a NOLGA NPC meeting in Denver. And it actually snowed on us, which was interesting. But it was a productive meeting, a lot of time on Colorado Bankers and Bankers Life for all the guarantee associations and updates on some other insolvencies. So the last item I put on the list, there will be the Western State Administrators meeting this year is going to be held in August in Girdwood, Alaska. That's a resort about 45 miles outside of Anchorage. So still a busy year and a lot of things going on, but this first quarter has been remarkably busy. But I think we've gotten everything accomplished. And that's all I have for the report.
Thank you, Boyd, for your report and all that you do regarding the Guarantee Association for Texas, as well as your work throughout the National Association. Next, item 7, consideration possible action on corporate governance issues. So, Boyd, I believe that's you as well.
Okay, this will also be brief. These are some normal reporting items. Firstly, antitrust, conflict of interest, and business ethic questionnaires. The antitrust certifications are pretty simple. The conflict of interest and business ethics have a few more questions, a little bit more to review. We have received all but one of the packages that we distributed, and that is an SDR that had served as a TPA on our behalf. It is not serving now, but they were for part of the year. We'll need to get them to respond, but I don't anticipate a problem. But I will follow up on that one small item. All the other responses, there was nothing noted that would cause a concern or require any additional follow-up. So again, those questionnaires and certifications were completed with no issues. I then want to remind the directors that 1 week from tomorrow is your deadline for filing your personal financial statements with the Texas Ethics Commission. Several of you have already copied me on your confirmation that you have filed them. Thank you very much. I had a member company stop me in Denver last week inquiring about participation and service on our board. And I walked them through what it would take. And I mentioned this item. They said, what? Your board files a personal financial statement? I says, yes. So again, a uniqueness of this association, how thorough its governance processes are, and this one's statutory, but it is much appreciated that all of you conduct the assembly and submission of those filings without any moaning or groaning. You guys are excellent. Thank you very much. And the last thing, this is a standard item. I always, in the distribution of the notice about the meeting, ask, are there any issues you'd like to discuss or bring up for the board on how we conduct the association or the conduct, to say it a little bit differently, of the board of directors. And no issues were raised. So I have nothing else to present.
Okay, thank you. That moves us to item 8, I believe.
Mm-hmm. We're just flying along here, aren't we?
Consideration and possible action regarding the impaired insolvent member insurers or related matters thereto.
Okay. So I'll begin here a couple of quick summary items. We have 21 active receiverships. Now, when I say active receiverships, we just list the ones that still are receivership proceedings in a court somewhere in the country, and we are one of the involved guarantee associations. We still have obligations on some insolvencies that the receivership proceedings have closed, but we continue to have policy obligations arise. So it doesn't cover everything. And the list is in your packet. There it is on 8.2, and you'll see There are three companies at the bottom: Senior Health Insurance Company of Pennsylvania, Colorado Bankers, and Bankers Life. We're not formally activated for those yet. And two, we think, are coming soon. Ship may be a while, if ever. So let me go back. So for the first 2 months of 2024, we funded almost $1.4 million to pay for policy obligations. We estimate as of February 29th, we have almost $33 million remaining to be paid on various insolvencies. We've collected only $991 and the we had $991 in distributions in the first 2 months of the year from liquidations. And we collected about $44,000 in premiums. As always, on 8-4, we provide the communications summary, copying the symbols, and it provides phone calls, website visitors. And then on 8-5, our complaint blog for 2024. And to go back, and I think since 2011, we've had one complaint in 13 years.
And it wasn't a complaint.
It wasn't a complaint. They thought we were somebody else.
Yeah.
It was for another insurance company. So I think we do conduct ourselves pretty well. So nothing there on the summary. If I could just roll into the specific insolvencies.
Yes.
Let's talk first about Bright Healthcare Insurance Company of Texas. We use the acronym BHICOT, and I'm just going to call it Bright. To be brief here, this was a liquidation that began on November 29, 2023. Bright had about 234,000 policyholders in the medical exchange under the ACA. And all those policies were terminated 12/31/2022. So a lot of the runoff of those policy obligations had occurred before we were activated. We have been working since November to set up the administrative process. Bright did have a third-party administrator that was handling the Texas business and the business in a few of their other states. Bright had companies in 13 jurisdictions. That TPA was Evolent Health. We entered a contract with them very quickly, but it's taken some time to go through all the processes. Some of that involved contractors and vendors of Evolent, and others were contractors and vendors of Bright Health Management, the management company. And Jackie was instrumental in leading and getting arrangements and negotiations and contracts in place with those vendors. So that did take some time. We also had to revise EOBs, EOPs, and the electronic remittance advices that go out for claims payments. Get those imported and built into the system for processing claims. But the most significant activity, which going into it was not anticipated, was all the work to set up a new bank account for the payment of claims. In our other health insurance insolvency in 2023, we were able to use an outside payment vendor. So we just had to fund to that vendor, and then they sent out payments. Bright had a different approach that the Bright management company funded into an account that was controlled by Bright Texas, and that account sent out the claims. We couldn't continue to use that account, and it was actually closed by the receiver. Any outstanding benefit payments were voided, so all those payments bounced. And so we've been working to set up a new payment account with the bank. To do that, we had to go back and use an old platform that we no longer use with JP Morgan Chase. So we have two accounts payable and banking platforms now in place for the association. In doing that, there were a lot of processes to set up the bank account, to set up the transmittal of the files from a subsidiary of JP Morgan Chase, that was actually a vendor of the TPA, to send over all the information on the payments. Long story short, we resolved it last week. We have not paid a claim. Just a moment ago, got a TPA, an email from the TPA, the out-of-network pricing occurred over the weekend. So the first batch of claims we'll receive in our request for funding should be this afternoon. We'll start the review of it and the testing for any statutory limit issues. And we're hopeful by the end of the week, payments will be on the street. And then we'll have weekly batches of claims going out the door for Bright. Right now, we know of about 6,200 claims that are in queue. We have approximately like 220 provider appeals and disputes that have been submitted. Not all of those involve issues involving the association. Some of them involve issues under the No Surprise Act that will be referred to the SDR, and also some return of premium issues that will be referred to the SDR. We learned after liquidation that Bright was in the process of calculating and paying return of premium. So some of these are unearned premium. A lot of them are just premiums that continue to be collected after the termination of the policies. They had actually provided letters to the policyholders telling them, here's the amount of money you're going to be refunded. But then they didn't refund it. So there are some 12,000 refunds outstanding. Mm-hmm. So we obtained the list, shared that with the receiver. So we're continuing to communicate with them about those refunds. So not a pretty picture. So what do we think we have in obligations in Bright? We know we have about $563,000 in voided benefit payments that we've already teed up and will be in this first batch to be reissued. I say here 5,600 claims in queue. It's about 6,200 now. We've got an updated number. And then the amounts we estimate for these 203 provider disputes, I put a number in, but we really don't know until we dig in deeper. A lot of these provider disputes, until we start processing, we don't know. There's only a couple of them we've actually begin to see numbers. I know one involved a hospital, about $1.4 million of billed charges. And all the issues have been resolved last June with Bright. But in our research in the claims platform, and we have full access to look at these claims, all work just stopped. Nothing happened since last June. And the provider was being very patient. When you finally get through to us, they were glad to at least get an answer. We went in the TPA to more or less process the claim offline, and we're going to owe about $484,000 on that one claim. So as we start digging in deeper, we'll know more on our obligations. So $6.6 million, we're estimating that could be easily be $10 million in obligations, but we don't know yet. We have not yet requested an early access distribution from the Bright estate until we know more what our obligations might be. But we anticipate that will happen, at least the request, before you meet in July. So it's been a kind of bumpy road to get Bright up and moving, but that's the same on every insolvency and very much the story on health insurance insolvencies. It takes some time to get it up and rolling, but we're anticipating, as I said, this week, claims, batches, and payments will start flowing. And that's Bright. Now, not all of them are that long. I'm sorry. Friday might be. So then we have Friday Health Insurance Company, another health insurance insolvency company participating in the exchange. Again, that company, 1 year on the exchange, 2022, they enrolled 304,000 policyholders. All those policies were terminated 12/31/22 as well. The association, though, got in the door a little quicker. We were in there March 23rd, 2023, with the liquidation order. And we previously reported the different structures we've used to administer this block. We had an agreement with Bright Management Company that was managing the company. We had a service agreement with them until they closed their doors July 7th. And then we participated in a third-party administration agreement with UST HealthProof. And that involved not only access to their platform, but also some engagement and sharing of some labor costs for about 100 employees of the former Friday company. Then there were about, I think there were 67 vendors that the five special deputy receivers in the other states that had Bright entities and this guarantee association We contracted directly with those vendors, and then we share the expenses for those vendors to provide various services to administer the business. Some of them involves pricing of claims. Some of them involve cloud services, internet access, everything down to snow removal at the building in Alamosa. There's a lot of vendors. Jackie worked on a lot of those, a lot of contractual arrangements. It did take some time, but it's in process and it's moving. So up until February 5th, we were paying weekly batches of claims. We paid 35 batches of claims, about 146,000 claims, $21 million. February 5th, we hit a wrinkle. The UST HealthProof TPA was using a software, a piece of software in their platform that had a glitch. And it, we noticed in a batch that came through, batch 36, pulled in claims that had been previously adjudicated and closed and hadn't been touched in over a year. These were not open claims. That platform pulled in the claims and repriced them based on, as if there had been changes in underlying provider contracts when no changes had occurred. So we noticed a couple million dollars in payments and dates of service that were outside the norm. So we froze the batches and asked them to go in, and we opened up a ticket with the vendor providing that software. Working with UST, it took 10 weeks to get an answer. And last week, it was finally resolved, and a batch of claims was released. So another 8,600 claims, $3 million were paid out the door last week, and another batch came through in the same time as well. So we're back up in funding, but it was a two-month, a little over two-month hiatus outside our control. Now, during that time period, we were routinely working with the vendor. We're talking to them. We're pushing them, nagging them. But that's all we could do. But we're back on in process, and we're moving right along. Jared provided me with an update. I think, Jared, what is it, 154,000 claims? Do you have those numbers? Where are we right now?
Yes, we have paid 150, almost 155,000 claims, totaling $24.1 million.
Thank you. So we anticipate looking at the claims between now and the end of June. Now, I mentioned a number, but it's a little bit soft. We think we have roughly another $10.2 million to pay. $10.2 million. Within that, we have an estimate for an issue that is pending with the special receiver involving provider overpayments. But then we also have what I'll call spreadsheet settlement claims. And Jackie's working on this. I'm working on this. We have several very large providers that we have approached and said, go through your accounts receivable. Identify anything for Friday Health Insurance Company. And we gave them a format of a spreadsheet to fill out. Put all your pending claims, any claims that you have disputes or challenges to the amounts being paid, get them on this list. And we will work through them. We're going to test them. We're going to resolve them. And we're going to settle with you. But once we do this, you're done with Friday. Full and federal. And so I will tell you, two of those very large provider groups, we have 777 pending appeals right now. 752 of those are resolved if we get settlements with these two large providers. Now, the numbers... And the first provider sent in a list and say, you still owe us $25 million. And we looked at it and said, we think you're wrong. First, you've got claims on here for the other Friday entities in the other states. You've got claims on here for dates of service after the termination of the policies. And you've got claims on here that we can't even look at because all you gave us was your internal reference account number and an amount you're due. We can't even test it. So there's a lot of work to go back and forth and resolve these. Why are we doing it? It's going to finalize our activities on Friday much, much quicker. With that, we only have roughly about 30 claims to process. We have the appeals, I said almost 800, and we have these spreadsheet claims. So we are anticipating that we can close out this insolvency this year. we'll do the best we can. Our one of our what aspects of our agreement with UST Health Source and the TPA agreement for the labor costs to work on our claims expired March 31st through NOLGA and one of the SDRs exam resources. We have engaged contractors, 18 contractors, to continue to provide services to process our claims and appeals using the UST platform. So the part of the agreement that stayed in place is access to the platform. They're just not doing the actual adjudication of claims. We'll do that with the contractors. We anticipate that's going to continue through probably September. So those 6 months of vendor fees, contractor fees, and bonuses that we offered these people, this Guaranty Association share of that's going to be about $725,000. So just to let you know, Jarrett mentioned we've paid $24 million in claims. We've already paid $10.4 million in admin expenses. Administration on this insolvency has been very expensive. We anticipate we're going to have another $2.7 million in admin expenses and a little, we mentioned $10.2 million in claims. So my rule of thumb on health insurance insolvencies, when I used to work on them decades ago, they're more expensive than life or annuity. So I'd use a 18 to 20% of paid claims as a percentage of admin expenses to claims. This one's running almost 50%. It's been a mess, really a nightmare. So we're back on track. We're paying right along. I just wanted to report we have a game plan to resolve this insolvency, and we'll be working on it more to report in July. Oh, I'm sorry. One other thing I just saw here. Provider overpayments. We had received a report from the third-party administrator, and we had asked for this, trying to identify any amounts that had been taken in provider overpayment offsets in the payment of our claims. Because initially there had been discussion with the Department of Insurance and the SDR, and we were instructed to remove the offsets for provider overpayments from the payment of our claims. Now, that is a customary regular practice in the health insurance marketplace, but we made that change. We turned off the offsets. We even confirmed with UST that they turned them off in May. Well, we got a report in that said the Guaranty Association had recouped over $5 million in provider overpayments in the payment of our claims. So we started investigating that. Large chunk of it was reported been conducted in June when UST confirmed that overpayments were turned off. And we started digging into it deeper, and we couldn't find these recoupments. We see our gross bill charges, we see our adjustments, we see our payment. But between the adjustments down to the payable amount and our payment is where offsets would come in. So we started looking into it provider by provider. Prime example, with one provider, we only adjudicated 11 claims. And the report said that we recouped $480,000 in the payment of those 11 claims. So I pulled the 11 claims. The billed charges submitted gross amounts for those 11 claims were only $105,000. How can you recoup $480,000 when you're only being asked to pay $105,000?
So what happened? It's
in process. Okay. So we've worked with the SDR. I had a call with the SDR's consultant from the airport Friday afternoon in Denver, and worked with him over the weekend and got some of his numbers, and he understands our issues, and he's trimmed. He's been able to reconcile the numbers within the TPA's reporting, but he has the same issues we have. That reporting is based on claims adjustments, but doesn't tie back to funding. So we have a call tomorrow. We have a call tomorrow. Early, because we have to talk with the TPA's team in India. And we've talked with them before to try to identify why the system is pulling up these weird recoupments.
That happened. Could it be the member cost share amount or something? Is there something weird?
It's not in the cost share. Everything I've seen, I walked through a couple of claims through the platform with our senior consultant, Gentry Skinner. And what it looked like is in the adjudication, if they made an adjustment in the adjudication, like they calculated something, went back and adjusted it, just through the adjudication process, the system was picking up every adjustment and it picked them up as if they were overpayments when nothing had ever been paid.
Okay. Yeah.
So that was a question I had. This 25.6 million, is that a legitimate, is that really a legitimate number?
They tell us that that number is legitimate.
That was paid.
That was overpayments because that actually started before liquidation, before we changed anything in the process. I think what is wrong is the recoupments. There have been additional overpayments created as we've been adjudicating claims because you have certain items within a claim get re-adjudicated and questioned. But the recoupments, I don't think we've taken any recoupments. The overpayments, the balance of the overpayments is probably correct. The recoupments is small. But we invited the SDR to participate in this because there's two questions to be resolved on the overpayments. If recoupments were actually taken and can be confirmed, we've committed to pay the estate for those funds because those recoupments are actually overpayments that were created pre-liquidation, so they're estate assets. So it's an early access to us. So we would pay them that money. Well, they turn right around and early access is to us. Okay, it's a wash in numbers for the association. Where it's not a wash, we are calculating statutory limits and tracking those based on the amounts we've paid. If overpayment credits were taken as recoupments, the gross or the amounts paid to the consumers or the benefit of the consumers was actually more, should have been included in our statutory limits. That's what worries me. So I'm trying to confirm the recoupments to make sure we didn't overpay on statutory limits to the consumers or on the consumer's behalf. The second piece would be we want to make sure the receiver has adequate and reasonable information that they can go pursue these overpayments with the providers.
Are there enough claims going forward to pull the recoupments out?
No. It's going to be go out there.
The provider, or the, what's happening, the provider is going to have to write a check.
Yeah.
Or at some level.
Yes.
Once it's proved up, but wow.
Yeah. Wow. It's
with ones that they recoup or tried to recoup. Well, let me ask you on the one that you just mentioned where they had 100,000 in claims. Payments, but they recouped $400.
I found $6,700 that I think was a recoup.
So the system's off, and so we never really recouped from the provider.
There's a little bit. There was a little bit, and let's make it really complicated. Did we recoup an amount that was a provider overpayment before liquidation, or a new overpayment that was created by a payment we actually made? If we made the payment, it created an overpayment, and then we recouped it. That's all within us. Mm-hmm. The receiver doesn't get that money. It's really difficult to track that. And that's why we've had a call with the Department of Insurance and the receiver for Friday and the receiver for Bright. And it's now agreed that in future, health insurance insolvencies provider overpayments will continue to be handled as they are in the industry. They'll be taken as credits and offsets because once we turned off that process,
it is gone.
It blew up. All the tracking and all the numbers, and I'm hopeful that we didn't ruin $30 million in recovery for the estate, but how defensible are these numbers? And provider contracts permit this.
Yeah,
the provider contracts.
And so does the statute.
I yeah.
Mean, well, offsets and recoupments, absolutely. You should do. But, if the, right. But I guess my point is that there's not enough claim going forward to do that, then what?
Yeah, they've got to go. The receiver's got to go
collect. Just get a check from the providers. Which
it's a very difficult process.
It'll be hard.
Oh my word! So we have our piece that we're trying to resolve, but then we're also trying to support the receiver to get as much in and recoveries as they can. But it's been a nightmare. It's been a lot of time too. Jared's been involved. I've been involved. We've done a lot of number crunching. And a lot of coordination with, but the good thing is the TPA, they are now saying they understand something wrong, that this didn't work right. And we'll find out this afternoon, well, tomorrow after, what's tomorrow morning? Do they think they have a resolution to try to identify exactly what happened? What are the true numbers? But
this may be just a really out there question. So, in the event that the providers are forced to, okay, you've got a write a check and they refuse to say, wait a minute, this was all messed up. Does the estate have action against the provider?
Mm-hmm.
They can take action.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, okay.
I mean, that contract provider, it says,
right,
that once there's an overpayment, the provider has to immediately pay that, or it can be taken as an offset to future claims. Now, there's a 45-day period when they notice the provider and they can challenge it. But after that period, it's a valid payable. Well, they just left it in there to be paid through the future claims. So it may be a surprise for some providers that they owe some money. We will see. I think it's going to be a lot of work to document lives.
Absolutely.
And just so you know, and this ties back in Bright, we turned that off also in Bright. Mm-hmm. The good thing is with Bright, their platform, as a claim is paid, you have a check number or an ACH reference number, and you can actually see when it was issued and if it clears. So if there's an overpayment, meaning the claims processing and the what I'll call the finance end of it for the funding is tied together in that platform. In the platform used in Friday, they were disconnected because they didn't use the TPA. They were using the claims adjudication process. So claims were being adjudicated. Then over here, the finance department did a different thing.
Oh, they weren't posting there.
No.
Oh, my God.
It wasn't connected. God. So you see that.
Oh, my God.
Because I asked them, you know, what about this claim? Well, that claim's paid. Well, it's paid per the claim system, but it has never been funded.
So going forward, you mentioned turning off that recoupment process. Is that like a standard that associated
it's not going to be done again?
That's what I was going to ask you. Okay, so going forward,
Been agreed going forward that the normal process for handling overpayments, including offsets, mm-hmm. will be continued. And you know, if it's continuing like that, and it's you don't have these unintended consequences in the accounting and the reporting, I think it'll be very easy for us to see, okay, what did the association take as an offset that was a pre-receivership overpayment mm-hmm. that's really an estate asset? We can account for that. In the Friday insolvency, because we turned it off, we can't.
And then you got one that took four times the number of actual payments.
I don't think they took it. The system shows it. The system just shows it. So in my conversation with the SDR's consultant Friday afternoon, I asked him, if you're going to bring up this $5 million with them Tuesday morning and you have any new documentation, send it to me. I won't say anything during the call, but I want to see what you're talking about. He said, well, I think that number is only 1.4. Okay. But I didn't get it this weekend. So the number that may be payable from the association is substantially less. All right. And last thing on Friday, we prepared over the weekend a number, a single page that, as you recall, we've only received $25 million in early access distribution from the Friday estate. We're now going to ask for $22 million more. And so as soon as we look at this one more time, it passes Jackie's test. Because Jarrett and I do this, and we say, Jackie, does it make sense to you? And if it doesn't make sense to her, we're not going to give it to the SDR.
I always tell them they know the numbers side of things. I don't doubt their numbers, but for the rest of us who are not really numbers people, we want to be able to read it and go, oh, I understand this.
So we're going to ask for $22 million. We did have a preliminary discussion with the SDR, and it doesn't seem like there's any issues. They want to have it documented. So we have good information to do that. So I do feel for both Friday and Bright, both, the association should recover all of its administration expenses and all of its claims obligations and should not have to assess. So
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
The 24 mil in claims paid today on Friday, does that include those TPA overpayments? You talked about 2 mil. There was $2 million, well, she said $2 million in overpayments and error with the TPA's process.
Well, no, the overpayments that were there was 26 million. The overpayments, the 26 million, that was all pre-receivership. The amount in overpayment recoupments, they say there's $5 million we recoup. So let's say we had a claim, it worked out that we should have paid $100,000, we paid $60,000. $40,000 is recoupment. They're saying if you add all those up since liquidation, it's $5 million. I can't document it. So there's $1.4 million that the SDR's vendor says he believes that's the true number we need to be looking at. Now, that's straight out of the accounting system and not out of our records.
What I'm talking about, and maybe we're talking about too, and I apologize. Yeah. He said it was a glitch.
The $2 million. We didn't pay that.
Okay.
No, the $2 million, there was a couple million dollars in the claims adjudication. They bought up old claims. We caught that and stopped the batch. We never paid it.
Okay. And to clarify, when you talk about moving forward in terms of handling the offsets.
Yeah.
But you haven't started making payments in Bright yet. How are you going to deal with the problem?
We're not. Because once we turned that off, the TBA had to do a lot of work to go in and reprogram their system to turn off those offsets. I've been talking with the SDR, and we agreed let's not have the TPA at this point go back and undo that programming. Two things, unintended consequences. Second thing is further delaying it and paying claims out the door. So we left it turned off.
The other thing too is in Bright, because there are not as many claims as there are in Friday, the whole reason for doing the offsets is not as, I guess, relevant.
Yeah. You're never going to have enough claims.
I just want to clarify, because you talked about moving forward and you haven't paid anything in Bright.
Yeah.
I just want to make it
clear. No. Friday and Bright are going to be left with no offsets for provider overpayments. But knock on wood, if there's another health insurance insolvency, we will follow the standard practice of the industry. All right. Any questions on those two? I know we took a long time to talk about that, but that doesn't scratch the surface how much time we've had in these two insolvencies. It's been through the roof. I know it's pushed both Jackie and I to retirement. So there you go. Okay. Let me move forward. I talked about both of these next two, Bankers Life and Colorado Bankers, and the board took an action there to authorize an assessment. And the only thing I'll add is I was asked recently to join an administration subgroup of the task force to work with the TPA to prepare for handling the surrenders and exchanges. And actually, it's not the calculations. The calculations of the coverage amounts and the calculations of what will be paid, it's just dealing with the volume, keeping track, handling all the calls, keeping track of the cash surrender requests and 1035 exchange requests. And 1035 exchanges require a lot more documentation, but there's some precision involved. So we've been working with the TPA about how many people they will have processing claims, how many people they'll have working on claims, projecting the numbers. And then we're doing currently some testing. Their calculations of a surrender or an exchange, how does it match back to our actuaries' calculations? Are we on point? Looking at their controls on maintenance of requests, handling calls, returning everything, the timeliness. So there's been a lot of work put into this. Also working to make sure that the 25% voluntary withdrawals that the rehabilitator at this time went to the court back in October and received the authority to make, have they all been properly reflected in the values? The problem being, we thought those would all be paid in late December, early January. They haven't finished making all those 25% withdrawal payments yet. They're behind on processing a lot of those. We need to make sure that we have the right numbers starting out and going forward. So a lot of testing, a lot of work, a lot of prep, but we should be ready to go mid-June or so. So we get around to being activated on both Colorado Bankers and Bankers Life. We'll be ready to pay these obligations. We will be talking to the board in executive session about a small coverage issue. It is a coverage issue that comes up regularly in our conversations with consumers day in, day out here at the association within Bankers Life and Colorado Bankers. It is an issue that's prevalent, but more prevalent in other states than Texas. The numbers in Texas is a very small number. So it's really a coverage position involving the amount of coverage afforded to jointly owned deferred annuity contracts. And we'll talk about that in executive session. Okay, to finish off the insolvencies, moving on here. Yes, I did. I'm sorry. Pintree Network America Insurance Company and American Network Insurance Company. We talk about these a lot, but you know, you have to remember these are insolvencies where we've paid out $1.7 billion today. And we think we have about $1.3 billion yet to pay. We still have, you see there, almost 34,000 policies in place, in force, 1,700 in Texas, and 3,800 open and pending claims. So this requires daily attention. I get emails and phone calls from the TPAs every day. I had two emails this morning before we started. There are always claims issues. I chair the group called the Policy Claims Administration Working Group. We are the principal place for the TPA to bring their issues. We're their first stop, and then we farm it out from there or get answers. I report not only to the NOLGA task force, but also to the board of directors of LTC Re, our captive. It's interesting. I sent out the quarterly report to those bodies last week from our group on administration activities in the first quarter of 2024. And Saturday morning, I had emails from the chair of the LTC Re board of directors. And you know Eric. And so he and I were emailing during the day on Saturday. So, you know, we've been involved in Penn Treaty since 2017, although I started working on it in 2009. It's not a new insolvency, but it's still very, very active, and we have a lot left to do. So I'm just going to mention a couple of items here. We've been working on some service level standards issues that have come up involving two of the standards. There are 25 standards we track the TPA on quarterly. Two of them involve some customer satisfaction surveys. We're having problems in distribution of the surveys, but we're having good results. We're getting almost 30% response rate. But between PACA and the Coordination and Strategy Committee, we redesigned those surveys to get a little better information. They were too clunky, too many questions, and we weren't getting actionable responses. So those were redesigned recently. It sounds like nothing. It took a year to do. And then we actually had to go in and make some revisions to exhibits in the service agreement to make sure they're properly reported. The wellness program, we're at the end of our second year of the pilot program. Between now and the end of May, we will have to reach a decision whether to discontinue that program and wind it down, continue it, or expand it. And I'll tell you, the numbers on the impact to claims are not demonstrable.
Is it because it's too far? It's too hard to, because of the tech lag, because
yeah,
when you're helping them and when they're not actually.
If you'll think about in managed care, your world,
yeah,
when you implement a wellness program, you get to see a little more immediate result.
And even those.
Right. And sometimes a wellness program, if you break even, you're doing well. This wellness program, we've started to see results, but it takes a long time for the results to kick in because you're looking at the wellness program's goal is to keep people in place, have them age in place, stay in their home rather than moving to a facility or initiating a claim. This program was implemented with 6,300 policyholders that are not on claim. So our intent was to get to them before they got on claim, keep them in place, grab bars, non-slip, magnifiers.
Rave toilet seats. I remember a big conversation about the importance of rave toilet seats.
There's a host.
Avoiding broken hips.
We've done over 2,800 interventions with about 300 policyholders, so some get multiple. And the net promoter score, you know how net promoter scores work. The net promoter score is in the 60s. So net promoter score, you're lucky. You know, health insurance industry, I've looked at the average recently, is around 17 is the net promoter score. Ours is in the 60s. People are happy. They love the program. But is it accomplishing the goal? It's a very hard thing to measure. So we have calls scheduled with the vendor and with our actuaries to go over the results in the next 2 weeks when we're making a decision. So it's been successful for the policyholders. hasn't been successful for us. Has it done what we've accomplished? So that is coming. And the other thing I'll mention here, the other program we've implemented recently is the electronic visit verification program. This is a rousing success. I killed the last program because it was very discriminatory. It was not well done. We went in and did a request for proposal, implemented this program last March, and we expanded it in June. We first implemented it to only the policyholders that were going on claim, new claimants. Then we expanded it in June to claimants by their annual recertification. So now you can see the numbers there. I have it. We have, there we go. Get to the right place. 273 participating in the program. Another 290 we're working through the pipeline to see if we can implement them. And in this, the caregivers use an app to record when they arrive to provide care, what care they're providing, and when they leave. So it helps on claims leakage. Instead of someone clocking in and say, on the piece of paper, written form, I got there at 8 and I left at 5. No, did they get there at 8:45 and left at 4:12? It records that level of detail. So we trim leakage on claims. But then also it has GPS and geofencing. So if they leave, or they check in to provide care and they're not checking in from that location. And we've had several. We had one check in from Mexico and one in the Caribbean. And because of that, we've had surveillance conducted on several. And there are potential fraud issues that we're working through. So we've even had a few people when we implemented the EVV says, you know what, I don't think I need this care any longer. So it has had a good impact. So we're tightening claims, we're reducing fraud, waste, and abuse. And let's say there's nothing going on along those lines. The timeliness for the submission of the care, and then every 2 weeks, the policyholder gets a summary that online, they get an email notification, they go online, they approve it. It cuts down processing time. Processing is done quicker, payments get out the door quicker. And so we're not dealing with hard copy statement of care forms. So I think this has been a very good program, and it's already very much paid for itself. And the last one is we're working on right now. I have a call this afternoon on it with our legal team. Two AI initiatives to bring in machine learning and virtual workers into the claims processing. The machine learning will, instead of using the 8 factors that manually being looked at now for fraud, waste, and abuse on claims, they will use 100 factors that through machine learning, they pick up on these factors and they identify them. Then they're referred to the special investigation unit for additional follow-up. So we will be able to identify more potential claims issues quicker and hopefully act on them. The virtual worker has two aspects. First aspect is indexing the documents that come in the door. It will read the documents, index them in the category they are, and route them properly. And that is a 24/7 process. Right now it's done manually during regular working hours. And the second thing, and this is with heavy QA on top of it, we will be implementing 100% virtual processing of claims. So the claims documents come in the door. Some of it is electronic, but through the virtual worker, they work the claim, they adjudicate it, they process it, and ready it for payment. If the QA works out well, we'll have it go ahead and go through the full payment process. So right now, there's a 10 to 12 day processing and payment period. We're going to cut that down into, it can actually be done in a few minutes, but it'd be same day submission and payment. So a huge benefit. But we have gone through about 2 months of review so far, and we're close to approving it. My committee will have to approve it, but the CNS committee will have to approve the new software and the introduction of 2 new vendors. So I think it'll be worthwhile, but on anything with AI right now, you need to make sure, where do you have the human control and the machine's not doing everything? And that's all on Penn Treaty. The last couple of insolvencies are just status, North Carolina Mutual. We're just rocking along paying benefits as they come due.
We've only funded about $200,000 in benefits, but you can see there what we think we have in covered value. Not a lot of money, but between the life and the annuities, it's going to be pushing a little over $11 million. Then the last one, Southland National, this is the other sister company in the global family with Bankers Life and Colorado Bankers. We're processing and paying benefits here. These are primarily prepaid burial contracts, and we've not had any issues. We think we have about $24 million here to pay, and we have paid, the right number there, $633,000 so far, so 29 batches have come through. I'm probably going to drop North Carolina Mutual and Southland National off our reporting to the board. We're just normal processing and runoff of claims. There's no actions for you to take on these, and that'd just be something I can annually update to you. So thanks for your forbearance here. We got into a little bit of detail on some of the insolvency, but that is the heart of what we do, and they've been somewhat complicated recently. And with that, I'm done on that.
Well, thank you. That was the last item in our regular session. The time is 9:58 on April 22nd, 2024, and I'm recessing the regular session of the Board of Directors meeting of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association in order for the board to meet an executive session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. The time is 11:30 on April 22nd, 2024. The executive session. Okay, I've said that. I'm sorry. The time is 11:30 on April 22nd, 2024. And the meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association.
Reconvene.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, you're right. Reconvene.
Okay. To reconvene. The time is 11:30, April 22nd, 2024, and I am reconvening a regular session of the meeting pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act.
There are too many of those, James. I assessed our assessment investment committee rather than adjourn. Too many paragraphs on
it. I remember that.
Okay, item number 10. Item number 11.
Well, 10, you can say there was no action necessary.
Item number 10, there's no action from the executive session that needs to be discussed in regular session. So item number 11, consideration possible action regarding the 2023 annual report.
Okay, a couple items to note on the 2023 annual report. First, the format has not changed. It's a consistent format. We didn't see a need to make any change. One of the things you'll notice right off the bat, the report from the chair, this is the last report that Jim Lewis will sign as chair of the association. As of 12/31/23, he was still the sitting chair. And then the rest of the report, we do not add language and information on every specific insolvency, just the highlights. And we try to only touch on at a very high level, trying to put as much as we can in there in summary statements and in graphical depictions, which at times can be a little difficult. But there was nothing unusual other than the insurance insolvencies we talked about previously. We had to put some information in there on them. And we always include the audited financial statements in this annual report, and with the approval of the audit earlier, we will add this. Should the board approve this annual report, we will file it with the Commissioner of Insurance before the end of April, as required by statute. So if there are any questions on the report, I'd be glad to answer those for you now.
Any questions? Hearing none, there's a resolution that's on your screen
about to be,
and also on page 11 in your board material.
We will take a question.
Director Frago has made the motion, and Director Harrison is second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 All right, motion carries. Thank you. All right, number 12, Jared, consideration possible action regarding the following financial and accounting matters.
Yes, sir. I'll try to be quick with this. All right, on page 12.2, see up there at the top note, we had $21.3 million mature, and we reinvested in February, which explains the huge jump in the cash and money markets. Overall, in January, we spent about $5 million in TPA expenses and claims for the Bright and Friday insolvency, so that explains the really big swing in cash and cash equivalents. Everything else on this net position statement is pretty standard. So let's go to the next page, please. Here you'll see a large change in the unbilled assessment. That is mostly due to this $3.7 million payment we paid for Bright for the TPA fees. Nothing really else on this page. And then the last thing I'll point out is because of the Bright insolvency, we've had to start doing the intercompany loans again. If you recall, the Friday did the intercompany loans, but we got their early access agreement and paid that back. And so we're now doing it again for Bright. And that's roughly the $3 million we paid in TPA fees for Bright shows up there in the intercompany loans. That's all I have to point out, unless anyone has any questions.
Frank, I'll point out here on 12.6. You can see this on the screen. Mm-hmm. This number, the 2% annual assessment limit is what we call our assessment capacity. So annually, we could assess this amount to the member companies for each line of business. So you see there for health insurance, $725 million. Mm-hmm. Overall, $1.3 billion. The association has never assessed more than $130 million in any one year.
Oh, wow.
So this is the maximum exposure that could be assessed to the industry by this association. That's our capacity. So we have plenty of capacity. We've never come close to maximum.
Wow.
Okay, that's all I got.
Is there a motion to approve the financial?
You don't have to. Okay. All right. Just a reporting item.
All right. Item 13, board.
Item 13, just to give you a heads up, we have tentatively looked at July 23rd, a Tuesday, being the next meeting for the board of directors, sticking to your normal quarterly schedule. As always, as you have time to check your schedules, you can tell me if you have a conflict. If you do, we can always poll the members for another date. There are an assessment investment committee and a personnel committee meeting scheduled prior to the meeting. Those are, I think, 1 week prior, Jim?
Yeah. I may have to do mine.
A little bit different?
Online.
Okay.
I'll be on vacation, but I could set up for
you. Okay. So if any of you have conflicts on this date, please let me know as soon as possible. I would like to schedule on the night of Monday, July 22nd, a board dinner.
Oh, we haven't done that in a while.
We haven't done a board dinner in a while. So if you would please let me know if you're available, can come in on Monday, the 22nd of July. I will find us a place for a nice dinner. I'll also, as standard practice, I'm required to post that with the Secretary of State, but I post it as a meeting, but no business will be conducted. So it does comply with the Open Meetings Act requirements. It's just the way we have to do our business.
Public can show up every day.
They can. They like. We will not buy their dinner.
Right.
But they are welcome to attend.
Meeting Monday morning and then dinner Monday night.
No.
Meeting Tuesday morning.
Meeting Monday night, dinner. Oh. Dinner Monday evening. Meeting Tuesday morning.
I'm walking on
the
first thing in the world.
There you go.
Hey, Bart.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. If I'm the only one with this conflict, I can send someone else. But just note, in case others plan on attending, the July 22nd through the 24th is the ACLI Compliance and Legal annual meeting in Florida this year.
You said 22nd to the 24th?
Right. And again, if I'm the only one that's planning on going to that, then I'll just send someone else. But if others are going, that might be a problem.
Well, the good thing about the July meeting, we have some flexibility. I have not looked, but I can quickly to see. Tell you what, I'll check it. I'd like to shift it maybe a week later because I'd like to have all the board in attendance if possible.
I can't do the third dinner.
I probably can't do the one that's the following week.
Yeah, Bart, 30th. Actually, the following week is worse for me as well. So I'm fine with keeping it there unless others were going to be going to that. I'll send someone else. The week before that is NQL. The week after that is a Florida meeting I do need to make. So I can skip ACLI compliance and legal and send someone else.
Okay, so it looks like we're going to try to stay with the 23rd right now.
22nd for the dinner.
22nd for the dinner.
And the 23rd. Meeting
on the 23rd. You're a busy group. We'll fix that. Okay. And Chair Huckabee, that's all we have. I think you conducted a very nice meeting, sir.
Well, thank you. All right, Toppin, when you were.
We're still recording, so I guess there's the final language. I'll turn it off.
The time is 11:40 on April 22nd, 2024. And this meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association that has been held pursuant to the Open Meetings Act is adjourned.